Folks, we have had a great partnership over the last year or so with Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, all American used cars and trucks. If you are in the Omaha area, and at some point we're all going to need to get our automobiles worked on, I am telling you right now, go to Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust. It's located at 4839 North 90th Street here in Omaha. Give them a call, 402-571-0944. They're going to treat you really, really well. Just be sure to let them know that a pen and a napkin sent you, and Juan Carlos and Esmeralda are going to do a terrific job of taking care of you. When you're in the market, if you're in the market for a new-to-you automobile, go to All American Used Cars and Trucks, 14706 Schooner Road, Omaha, Nebraska, 68138. Juan Carlos has got a great operation out there, basically 144th and I-80. So either way, if you're looking for a new-to-you car, if you're looking for repair services, go to Ruiz Auto Services, All American Used Cars and Trucks. Let them know that a pen and a napkin sent you. They are going to treat you with care and love. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of A Pen and a Napkin Podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to the coaching staff, episode number 139, and I am back with my guy, Mr. Tony D. Viss. I really want to thank Jim Simons for pinch hitting last week and doing the John Thompson podcast that we did about Coach Thompson, but it's great to have Tony back. Tony, how you doing, buddy?
We're doing well. And after listening, like we're talking about off air there, after listening to Coach Simons and you do your thing, I was like, man, this guy's better than I am. I better get back on that before I'm permanently replaced. But he did a fantastic job.
Well, I don't want to say the name Wally Pipp came up on more than one occasion, but it may have. So, no, I couldn't do that to you, Tony. In fact, I feel like This is really the way that I feel.
You complete me. I love you.
You little Dr. Evil for you there, buddy.
Dr. Evil.
Yes, you complete
me. Like,
yes.
One.
Speaking of $1 million, we want to dive into developing point guards. And if you've got a great point guard, you know just as well as I do, Tony, that's $1 million thing to have on your roster. And at some levels of college basketball, it takes $1 million to have a really good point guard on your team. So
the way that thing's happening with NIL, it might be $1 million for a backup point guard, Marty.
Yeah, I know. I can only imagine what I would have pulled in NIL at Briarcliff for intramurals.
You'd be set right now.
Yes, I'd be able to retire. But back in the class. Well, not back in the classroom. Back for teachers' meetings tomorrow. Tony's going back later in the week, so we are back at it. Episode 139. We are going to talk about developing point guards. Let's talk first a little basketball history. Tony, 1955 NBA champions. Who do you have on your bingo card, my friend?
We've been with the Lakers for a while, so I'm gonna roll the dice with them. And if it's not them, I'm probably going to need to go Boston or the Knicks.
Oh, for three. Yes.
Better go back to vacation.
Yes. Let me look this up because I want to make sure I get this correct. The NBA champions in 1955 were the Syracuse Nationals.
I never would have got that.
Yes.
Dolph Shays,
yes. Dolph Shays made his debut in 1949. They defeated the Fort Wayne Pistons in seven games, 4-3.
Matt Ames?
What's that?
Not the Mad Ants.
Not the Mad Ants. No,
Wayne, aren't they the Mad Ants?
I think they are now. I think they. Or is that Indian? I don't know. Keisei Tominaga plays for the Indiana. I thought they were the Mad Ants for some reason. Mm-hmm. And he's with Indiana. So
Mad a lot. So there could be more than one.
Yes. Yeah. I've got a couple of those in my life. Just kidding. Anyway, no, the best player for the Nationals was Dulshays. This was the 1954-55 season. This was the first NBA season with the shot clock, Tony, the invention that saved professional basketball, the 24-second shot clock. And both of these franchises still exist today. Pretty easy to figure out. The Fort Wayne Pistons are now the Detroit Pistons. Yes. Syracuse Nationals. Do you know what franchise they are today, Tony?
The humor side, I mean, I'll say the Washington Nationals. Obviously, that's the wrong sport, but yeah. No, I don't.
They are now the Philadelphia 76ers. Yes. So. Yes, so that is the Syracuse Nationals 1955 NCAA championship. Who you got there, Tony?
Is that Texas Western?
No, we're still quite a ways from that.
We got to get them soon. Kentucky.
That is incorrect as well.
Canberra. I'm on my way back to Indianapolis.
San Francisco, the University of San Francisco. Yes, they defeated LaSalle, who was going for back-to-back championships. They defeated LaSalle in the title game 77-63. The best players for San Francisco, the Dons, Casey Jones, and yes, this guy named Bill Russell, who went on to do... He won a couple of championships along the way. So there's your basketball history. Let's dive into developing point guards. Tony, to me, it's if you are not taking care, if you do not have a great point guard, to me, you better be really, really loaded at the other four positions if you are going to be successful. Point guard play is perhaps, in my estimation, agree, disagree, let me know, Tony, the most important position on the floor, and it's the position that requires the most tangible and intangible qualities to be successful at the position.
The interesting thing is, as I take a look at this one, because I agree with what you're saying, but I don't know in today's world if you're going to get unanimity on that, because the whole positionless thing, and then, you know, you see more and more where different players initiate the offense rather than the point guard. And so I don't know, in today's modern basketball, is it where it once was? But then at the same time, if you ask me, Tony, you can have good guards, you can have good post play. I'm going to say good guards every time.
Yeah.
And so this one's kind of a tough one to wrestle with. And I feel like I might talk out of both sides of my mouth on this one.
Well, I want to point out two things. Number one, I don't know where you pulled out the word unanimity. There's six syllables right there. That you must have been studying a thesaurus or something on your way out to Indianapolis and back. But no. Sorry. And you rolled it off, man. Like, that was that was some high level stuff right there.
Everyone's fathers go brain, man, for some reason. I don't know.
I think when we're talking about point guards, I think and Rick Pitino talked about this, and this, you know, Tony and I decided to talk about this a week and a half ago. So this is not something that, because of Pitino's, did you see Pitino talk about it on social media, Tony, or there was a clip about it? He basically said there's no such thing as a traditional point guard anymore.
Yeah.
They're combo guards.
He was talking about, somebody asked him, Jalen Brunson.
Yeah.
And then he said he has to score, and he should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think what we're looking at is maybe like floor general, floor leader, instead of just saying point guard. Like Cade Cunningham, who is, I mean, I think you more technically qualify as a point forward type or whatever. You know, that guy, you know, Steph Curry is technically a point guard, but he doesn't play the position the way Isaiah Thomas or John Stockton played it. But I guess when I say that statement, that it's the position where you have to have the most tangible and intangible skills, it maybe is not necessarily point guard, but maybe the floor leader, the offensive leader of the offensive unit out there on the floor. Maybe that's Draymond Green in that case, where it's a little bit more of a point forward type of a situation. That's kind of what I meant by that statement, Tony. I don't know. Does that help clarify that statement?
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, Paul Pressey was kind of the godfather, if you will, mm-hmm. with Don Nelson and what he did with the Bucks, however many decades ago. But yeah, I mean, I just sit back and I look at it. And one of the great things about the game of basketball is I think you can do it so many different ways. And so, you know, whether it is a point guard, point forward, floor general, whatever, you have to have somebody who is the leader who initiates things. I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. What are some of, and I don't know if you have this listed out or not, Tony, what are some of the qualities that you have for your floor leader, your floor general? Again, point guard, point forward, the development of that floor leader. What are some things that, in your estimate, when you've had that great leader on the floor, what are some of the qualities that they have had?
You know, I think they handle the ball really well. So kind of like it's on a string, if you will. They really can handle it well, because one of the things that you see is a lot of pressure, ball pressure and pressure defense, full court, that type of thing. And you have to have somebody who can get people organized, you can get the ball into, and they can get their way, they can work their way through a zone press or a man-to-man full court trap, whatever the case may be. But they have to have that control. And that's one thing I would put out there. Another one is court vision. They have to be able to see the floor. They can't get locked into, you know, a side of the floor or even a smaller area than that. They have to be able to see the entire thing. And they're passing, you know, I was looking through some stuff and it was interesting because I think it was Shane Battier was talking about the difference between playing with Tracy McGrady and LeBron. And he said that McGrady always would hit him in the shot pocket. And he thought that Tracy McGrady was a better passer than LeBron, which I thought was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And then I think this kind of all boils into an overall category of decision making, mm-hmm. you know, the decision of when to attack, when to pull the ball out and to use the clock to your advantage, when to set up a teammate, when to score yourself. I think that decision-making might be at the top of the list, to be honest with you, but those are a handful of things that I look at as the responsibilities and the skill set of pretty much that floor leader, that point guard, or whoever initiates your offense. I think those are things that have to be stressed.
Mm-hmm. I like your list, Tony. I want to add a few things onto it that I had listed out before we got going on, if you don't mind. But toughness, I think, is a huge one. And you spoke of, and I think this is a great combination. You spoke of a lot of tangible things on the floor. My list is a little bit more intangible, or the mental game. And those things work hand in hand. So I think by the time folks get done with our list here, I think they're going to have a pretty good list of things that they would want out of their floor general. Toughness, again, like I said, mental, especially mental toughness, steadiness. And that kind of is hand in hand with mental toughness. You don't want a point guard, you don't want a floor general that gets two up or especially two down, hangs their head, gives you the hound dog look. You've got to move past it. You've got to be the most mentally tough player. You've got to be the steadiest player. With that being said, your point guard's going to make mistakes. Your floor general's going to make mistakes. It's just like a quarterback. They're going to throw an interception every now and then. Sometimes it's their fault. Sometimes it's not their fault, you know, but it's going to happen. You got to move on to the next play. Leadership, I think, is a huge factor when we're talking about floor generals and the people that are going to be in charge of your team. You know, one of the things that I wrote in the Hoops 365, you only get to stop the game. There is really, at most, there are 13, in a high school game, you have 13 stopping points. You've got your quarter and halftime, so there's three. You get five timeouts, they get five timeouts. So there's 13. There's 13 times where you can kind of get everything set up, you know, in a perfect world, exactly the way that you want it. You've got to have a leader out on the floor that's going to handle the other well over 100 situations where you don't get a chance to get everything set up the way that you want. And it's got to happen at both the offensive and the defensive end. So I think leadership is a big part of it. And the last one that I had written down, Tony, and this is kind of that Isaiah Thomas model, the adaptability to your teammates' skill sets. You know, Isaiah was he was a guy that probably could have averaged 25, 27 a game, but he chose to average 17 to 19 a game because he set up everybody else. But when it came to time for him to score, he was going to score. And I think that is that adaptability, understanding what your team needs of you at that time. And those, you know, again, we're talking about the cream of the crop at the high school, at the college, at the professional level. But the more between our two lists, Tony, the more boxes that a player could check there, the more elite your floor general is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I think sometimes we as coaches kind of handcuff our players with, you mentioned earlier, the 13 stoppages. If you're stopping your practice all the time and you're talking, you're not really simulating the game. And one of the things I think that's so very important is you want your practice to be harder than the game, and you want your practice to be chaotic, because in those moments, you've got to find out who your leaders are, because when it's not going the way that you want it to go and it's chaotic, who's going to step up and who's going to lead? And, you know, I think things work best when it's the person that initiates the offense and stuff like that, and is kind of the quarterback of the defense as well. But yeah, you've got to find that out in practice. And if you're doing all of that work, you're stifling and handcuffing your kids.
Coaches, it's getting to be that time of year again. It is time once again for the Metro Basketball Coaches Association Fall 2025 Coaches Clinics. We've got a great lineup of coaches ready for you to come in and learn from here in the Omaha metro area. If you are a high school or college coach within a 30-mile radius of Omaha, you should be signing up for the Metro Basketball Coaches Association Clinics, everything that the program has to offer. Here's what we've got. September 17th, Wednesday, September 17th, we got Brian Cooley, the University of Minnesota men's assistant coach. He is going to do both sessions that evening. On September 24th, my childhood friend, my lifelong friend, Dick Jungers, the head girls basketball coach at Newell Fonda from Iowa. He's going to come down for an hour. And then the second hour, we're going to have Alan Huss, Creighton men's associate head coach, the man in waiting, the guy that is going to take over for Coach McDermott whenever Coach Mack decides to hang up the whistle. He's going to come in and give us some great knowledge. October the 1st, Krugs, my guy Krugs, my good friend Mark Kruger, head girls basketball coach at Miller West High School here in Omaha. He's going to be there for the first hour. And then Nate Linzer, assistant men's basketball coach at the University of Nebraska. Great guy. Took care of my son for 3 or 4 years down in Nebraska with Coach Hoiberg. Coach Linzer is going to come in and give us some great knowledge that evening. And then our last Wednesday, October the 8th, we're actually going to be on the floor with Jamie Carey, who is the new women's basketball head coach at Omaha here. She's going to do an on-court demonstration at Brownell Talbot High School here in Omaha. She is really starting to hit the local circuit hard. She is recruiting kids from the area, and she wants to get involved with the Nebraska and Omaha, especially Omaha area coaches. So coaches, come out and check her out. Doors are going to open at 6 each week, happy hours from 6 to 7. We're going to have wings. We're going to have beverages. Speakers start at 7 o'clock. We're going to have door prizes. The first 3 weeks, September 17th, 24th, and October the 1st, it's going to be at Legends Sports Bar at 69th and Pacific here in Omaha. Like I said, on October the 8th, the last evening, it's going to be Brownell Talbot, just off of about 55th and Dodge in that area there, Memorial Park area. If you would like to register, here's the great thing. Tom Crable, our president, has got a great thing set up for you now. If you register before September the 1st, you're going to get an early bird special of $75 per coach. So that's less than 10 bucks an hour to come in and get great knowledge with great networking opportunities and socialization and getting to know your fellow coaches in the area. $75 a coach if you pay before September 1st. After September 1st, it's going to be $90 per coach on your staff. So it's a great opportunity for not only for you to grow, but for your staff to grow. If you would like to register, when you decide to register, send your registration and fees to Ralston High School. Attention, Mr. Tom Crable, K-R-E-H-B-I-E-L, 8969 Park Drive, Ralston, Nebraska, 68127. If you're making out a check, make it out to MBCA or Metro Basketball Coaches Association. Coaches, again, if you're within a 30-mile radius of Omaha, you should be signing up for the Metro Basketball Coaches Association Fall Coaches Clinics. Tony, you know, I think we officially need to change this. We talked about developing point guards, but I think the official title we need to give to this is developing floor generals. So I think that's the title we're going to use with this. How's that sound? Are you okay with that, my friend?
I'm more than okay.
All right. What are some, what's kind of your next bullet point about what you wanted to talk about with the development of floor generals?
You know, one of the things I would also go to is the fact, you know, floor general, we've talked primarily about the offensive side of the ball. And one of the things I think that's also very, very important is you want a two-way floor general. You want somebody who can pressure the ball full court and just become somebody that when the, you know, the other team's best player or their floor general or whatever, they're going to have an off night when they see your kid because your kid's going to get up into them and get under them and really frustrate them. And so you want to make sure that their defense is something that's very important to them as well. Not just only one side of the floor, you want them to make sure that they're a two-way player. And so that would be the next area I would also address there as well, would be that defense.
Well, it's kind of like the old saying, Tony, and again, we'll compare it to football. If you have two quarterbacks, you don't have any quarterbacks. And so if you've got a good defensive point guard and a good offensive point guard, you really don't have floor general. You don't have a real floor general. You have half of a floor general. And there are situations where that can work. Like, again, we're going to use high-end examples. 99.99999% of us don't have players at this talent level. But for the Warriors, as the example, you know, Draymond is the leader of the defense and Steph is the leader of the offense, and his gravity makes everything happen. That's the rare situation where you can get away with that. But that, again, that's few and far between. That floor general, that point guard S player, like you said, I agree with you, Tony. You got to be able to play both ends of the floor, and that goes for any situation with all five of your positions. I know one of the things I would do on my game sheet is I would write out, okay, here's my 3-point team at the end of the game. If we need to shoot a three, if we need to, you know, if we need to press, here's this. And one of the things that I realized as I became more seasoned and experienced is the more names I had to use to fill in those blanks, usually our season was not as good as what we would have liked it, because we didn't have complete players that you could just say, hey, you know what, in the last 3 minutes of a game, I know we're going to go with these five or six kids, depending on the situation. That's who we're going to roll with. And when you have that floor general that you have to kind of tap dance and move around, it makes it difficult to really be as successful as you want to be.
Yeah, and the one thing I would give you with Steph, because I mean, obviously he's an amazing offensive player. He stretches the defense, can hit threes from pretty much once he gets over half court there. Is at least he tries on the defensive end. It might not be his cup of tea, but he does try on the defensive end. And that's the one thing I will give him and why I think Steph is a complete player. He's not a lockdown guy, but he is a complete player because he does try on that end.
I agree. Yeah, he was talking, I think it was last year at USA Gold Camp that I was coaching at, and the kids were, you know, of course it was either dunks or threes. I'm like, watch Curry, his off the bounce game now sets up his 3-point shot, and his off the bounce game is good. Now, is it as good as his shooting? No, but it's gotten to the point where he's such a tough guard on all three levels because he can play it at multiple levels, and he's developed that. And I think kids, and I get it, we're taping this on Sunday night. I saw on social media, it's the year, was it last year that we won the gold and Curry hit the daggers against France at the end of the game? So, you know, it's kind of Steph Curry day, if you will, but it's that balance to his game that makes him so difficult on both ends of the floor. So,
and that game against Serbia in the semis was unreal too.
Yeah.
That might have been one of the best Olympic games I've ever seen.
Yeah. You had said this, Tony, about giving players a chance to lead. If you're talking all the time in practice, your four generals don't get a chance to be the general. If you're the general the entire time, then they don't have a chance. Now, again, I understand that there are times where you have to talk, you have to dictate things, you have to start drills and put people in certain situations. But one of the things that I would try to do, and not just with our floor generals, but various different players, is I would do things in practice to try and put them in a position of leadership in the middle of practice. So we would do things like, I would tell the floor general, hey, we're going to do burt drill. That's the only person I would say, you get it organized. We're running burt drill. And they would have to holler out burt drill. And they were the ones, you know, you got 15 seconds to get burt drill organized, or you got, you know, 10 seconds to get call the name transition organized, or whatever it may be. I would do a lot with 5-on-0. So I would, you know, when we were working on 5-on-0, I would be up at the top with my point guard and I would say, hey, we're going to, next play is Chicago, get it figured out. You're in charge, you know? And if I had a nickel for every time I said that, I'd be all right. You know, those are that type of things. You know, a lot of times along with that, I would only instruct the point guard or the floor general, and then they would have to instruct the whole team. And again, that gives them the opportunity to be the voice that everybody else is following. And they have to communicate with their teammates, and their teammates have to communicate with them by listening, because communication is talking and listening. And to me, that was one of the things that I constantly tried to do with my floor generals. And I was tough on my floor generals. I was not easy on them, because I felt like I said at the top of the podcast, this is the most important situation. This is, in my mind, it was the most important position that we had. And you've got to be a take charge person. You've, at least on the floor, I've got to be able to trust you, and I've got to stress you out in practice so that when we get to Friday night, you're ready to go. So that's some of the things that I would do to put our floor generals in situations where they were forced to be the general in practice.
Yeah, because one of the big things of a team, you know, and really no matter what sport, is you have to have trust. And, you know, it's one of those things where they've got to believe in each other. They've got to have trust in each other. And if you're all the time the one that's the marionette that's pulling the strings and doing that, you're not allowing them to do that. One of the things I've done pretty much every summer is I don't call the plays out. I make the floor general, whoever that may be, and it might be multiple people out there, but I make them call it out. As soon as we get the ball and we're going the other end, the goal is we want the play called out before we get across half court, unless we have a layup in transition. And so I think you have to start that early where you call the plays out loudly. And then, like you mentioned, there's going to be over 100 of stoppages in a game. You have to have someone or some ones that have a voice during that time that can get their teammates together, get them organized during a dead ball. And then the other thing you have to understand too is they are your representation on the court, and you want to make sure that you don't cut them off the legs, that they're giving positive reinforcement and they're correcting their teammates in the right sort of way. But that goes back to what I talked about earlier. They aren't going to be able to correct their teammates if they don't have their teammates trust. And so I think what you were doing, which was assigning leadership responsibilities in practice, was so very, very important. But yeah, you have to have that voice out there, because when, you know, like when we've talked about, when it's stressful, somebody out there has to have a cool head and has to provide that direction that's needed for all five players to pull the rope in the same direction.
Yep. What else you got, buddy?
You know, some other things I would take a look at, I know you kind of talked a little bit about this earlier, but some of the mental stuff, you know, one of the things that might be important to talk with your point guards or your floor generals or whatever title you want to give them, you know, have them journal after the game about the decisions they made in the game. At this point in time, I called out this play, you know, and just kind of go back and have that reflection time. I think that's important. And then kind of what you're doing, Marty, with your guards out there, you know, when they're doing 5-on-0 stuff and, hey, we're going to run Chicago or whatever, you have to be able to work with them to keep their poise under pressure, because that's going to be so very, very important. And then as you're kind of walking through the offense with them, give them the cues in terms of what to read. Like we go through our kids on a lot of stuff, like if the defense is going to ice the ball screen, or if they're going to switch the ball screen, or, you know, if they're playing, you're running your player off a stagger screen, if they're doing this, if they're trailing, if they're going to cheat on it or whatever. But you're talking about how to make reads with them as well, and just give them some of those visualization things, so when they happen, they know how to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the constant education, that verbal. And I think that leads to one of the things that I wrote down, Tony, is building mutual trust. You know, the the floor general realizes that when you call Chicago, they feel good about it. They know what they're doing, and they know that the, you know, they feel good and confident about the play call. They come over to you and they say, "Hey, let's run Detroit." Okay. Sometimes you got to give them a little leash and say, "Hey, if you feel it, let it rip." You know, now there's a time and a place for it. It's not always that way. Sometimes you got to say, "Hey, you know, I like that you're thinking about it right now, but I don't think that's the right one for us, but I like the way you're thinking." You know, you got to take it and you got to spin it into a positive, you know, so, but building that mutual trust, I think, is so very important with you and your floor general. They've got your back. You've got their back. Like I said, they're going to make some mistakes out there. They're going to make the wrong calls. They're going to turn the ball over. They're going to take a bad shot every now and then, but you have implicit trust. And if you say that you trust them, you have to show that you trust them. You have to put those actions, you have to put those words into action as they, you know, have a night or two where they might struggle. I was as hard as I was on them in practice, I hope that my floor generals look back on it and go, "Man, he kind of drove me nuts in practice, but on game night, he gave me a lot of leash to make some things happen." And I think that's, hopefully they had that trust in me because I tried to give them that trust as well.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things too, because of the fact that, you know, you are a little bit harder on them, but at the same time, it's because you care and you're trying to get them to be the best version of themselves. And I think it's one of those things where, you know, there might be times that, you know, you butt heads or whatever, but at the end, that relationship is so very, very close because they have become that extension of you out on the floor and have maybe, you know, stepped into some of those leadership things and different things that they see what you go through and they kind of get into sync with you a little bit too. So I think it can be a really, really cool relationship as well.
Mm-hmm. I've got one or two more things, Tony. What do you got?
Yeah, I just got a few here. The first one I would throw at you is you got to let them fail. I know you talked earlier about the fact, you know, you mentioned they're going to throw an interception. They're going to have a turnover. They're going to force a shot on occasion. But here's the thing. If you let them fail, I think one of my greatest teachers in life has been failure when I've had setbacks and I learned from it. Like, I don't want that to happen again. And so I think sometimes those failures, those mistakes, whatever you want to label them as, can be that fuel for growth going forward. And then the other thing too, that's also kind of interesting is that it works out well. And I'm speaking more from a varsity coaching perspective than you know, like what I have with a sophomore. But if you have an older point guard, a more experienced point guard, they can kind of pass the baton on to that next one. Maybe they're a junior and the other one's like a freshman or a sophomore or whatever. But when things are done, they can pass the baton on to that next one who can then mentor that next one. You just kind of have like this thing where, because sometimes they can be the one that helps, you know, make coach speak a little bit easier to decipher for their teammates.
Yeah, that's where you can have Billy tell Joey, "Here's what he's saying. Here's what he means." I, you know, a year or two ago, I was in the same situation. Here's how you figure it out. This is what he wants from you. Those are conversations that you hope, if you have a player-led program, and the players are willing to buy in that, yeah, I'm hard on you at times, but what I'm trying, like you said, Tony, I love the way you put that, you know, essentially, you know, I'm trying to put you in a situation where you can max out and you can be as good as you can be. And there are times where you have to ask more of the player than what the player is asking of themselves. And you have that butting of heads, as you referred to. So that is all in that development. And one of the best things that we had happen, it was a very satisfying moment in my coaching career. We had a group, we brought back in two or three kids. They asked if they could come and talk to our team. And they were about 2 or 3 years removed from playing. And it was, yeah, absolutely, sure, great kids. So they came into practice and we said, "Hey, go in the locker room. They want to talk to you." And you know, I can say this now because it's been almost 15 years, but yeah, we kind of eavesdropped a little bit, you know, but one of the things that one of the players that I butted heads with, I'll be honest with you, but she told the team, she goes, "I get it. he was really hard on me. There were times where I didn't like him very much, but when it was all said and done, I got it. I understand what he was trying to do. And you've got to listen to him. He's trying to get you to where you want to go. And you know, again, I'm not John Wooden. I'm not Mike Krzyzewski, but that was like, okay, that was just a feel good moment for me as a coach that like, I get it, you know, and I felt good that, okay, what I am doing is actually worth the kind of butting of heads that you have occasionally with players, because sometimes it just takes a little while for them to get it. And you should have at times, and I think this is a point, Tony, if you've got a good floor general, they're probably pretty mentally tough and they're kind of stubborn just like you. And there probably should be every once in a while a little bit of butting of heads because they're strong-willed, and you need that strong-willed kid when you're tied with 2 minutes left to go on a Friday night, right?
Yeah. Or, you know, you're down six with a minute and a half, you know, and you need to get a bucket. And yeah, you've got to have that strong-willed kid. And I think sometimes, you know, you'll see different highlights on X or whatever of teammates or a coach and player having a blow up or whatever. That's sports. That happens in sports. Now, how you handle it after the fact is super important. But mm-hmm. in that middle where it's crazy, you're going to have that from time to time.
Yeah. Yeah. If you didn't care, you wouldn't have those situations come up. And so I think that's, you know, you don't want it to happen every game. That gets old.
Yeah.
You know, that gets old. But if it happens once a season, it's not a bad thing. It's okay. No. It's okay. So the last couple of things that I had, Tony, with your floor generals, you start with making the simple play. So as you, and you kind of referred to it with the mentorship between, let's say, a senior who's talking to the sophomore who's going to be your next guy or gal up over the next couple of years. And I think as you ease your floor generals, and this goes for almost every position, but as you ease them into that new role, okay, let's just start with simple plays. And once we've made simple plays, then we'll get into more elaborate stuff. But I think you really emphasize that to your floor generals as well. And then the last thing is you need, and this goes again for every one of your players, but especially your floor generals, in my opinion, again, this is just my opinion, I think you need to be really, really smart about how you design your system X's and O's wise that it fits their strengths. You need to put that floor general in the best position possible to succeed. Now, you're trying to do that for every single player. Don't get me wrong. It's important to do for every single player, but there's a little bit more emphasis on that. If you've got a floor general who, again, let's take two players right now. Steph Curry is not an on-ball, run 1,000 pick and rolls and let me do this and this, floor general offensive point guard or whatever. What's he wants to do? He wants to give it up, and he's going to come off a bunch of screens and different things like that, and he's going to get it back. And that's the way he creates gravity and chaos. Whereas you have, again, let's go to the complete opposite end of the spectrum. You've got James Harden, who's dribbling the air out of the ball and wants to pick and roll, pick and roll, pick and roll, and isolate. Now, for a long time, that worked well. It's not aesthetically pleasing. It's not quite utilitarian or whatever word you used earlier, but aesthetically is close to that. But, you know, it's two different systems. Steph Curry would probably not be as successful with what James Harden does, and James Harden's not going to be as successful with what Steph Curry does. And so you've got to design those things. And what worked for your senior point guard for the last couple of years when they were a two-year starter for you, you've got to rethink it for that sophomore or junior, whoever's stepping in for that kid coming in the next season. So that's kind of my last couple of points there, Tony.
Yeah, you bring up some really good points there in terms of, you know, especially with high school, you know, you've got to make your system fit the players and not the other way around. And the other thing I like too, you know, sometimes when they come up as a floor general, they probably feel like they're drinking out of a fire hydrant. It's on full blast. And so to make sure, like you said, let's work on making the easy read. Just do the simple. And then as time goes on, we'll add to the complexity of it. You know, one of the things that with our guys, like we always play really fast. We always play fast. But by the time we get to middle to end of January, I start to mess with some things tempo-wise a little bit. it, because I feel like, hey, November, December, and then about half the month of January, been playing fast, fast, fast. And now you've got to be able to make some adjustments as we go. And so I think that gradually increasing the complexity of what you're asking them to do is a very, very wise decision as well.
Coaches, we're all here to hone our craft. Now, one of the great ways that you can help hone your craft is realizing that you need to be the CEO of your program. I really think I put that together for you, and here it is in Hoops 365, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO. I've got 365 different topics under 10 different content areas: book studies, coach studies, X's and O's, culture, game day operations, skill development, personal development, practice, off-season workouts, and miscellaneous coaching topics. So if you want to come in and you want to know how to implement the 2-3 zone defense or how to implement the triangle offense, it's going to be in there. If you want to know more about Don Meyer, it's in there. If you want to know more about building a great culture and the concepts and ideas that you should be looking at to building a great culture, it's in there. So Hoops 365, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO, is a terrific tool for any coach to use at any stage of their career. On each page, there's probably about two-thirds of a page of writing, but on almost every single page of the book, it's got space to journal, to write out X's and O's, to put your thoughts down. It's 365 different concepts, but what it's asking you to do is to think about what you're going to do, how you're going to study this subject, and how you are going to make your program better. Hoops 365, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO, will be out on Tuesday, September 16th. It will be available on Amazon.com for $26.99. It is going to be a terrific investment for you as a coach, as a human being. It's going to make your program better. Take 3 to 5 minutes every single day. Think about this concept. Think about what you're going to do and put those thoughts immediately down on paper. Think of it as a basketball coaching workbook, and that's exactly what this book is going to be. So coaches, look to pick up Hoops 365, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO, on Tuesday, September 16th on Amazon.com. Well, Tony, you know who is wise beyond all of their years, my friend.
Europe.
You know, Jim Simons did a really, really nice job in his Lenny Harris pinch hitting role last week, but I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed. He was not aware of the band Europe, and you know, Jim did a great job, but got to ding him for that a little bit here. You know, so that's okay, Jim. Still love you, man. So
come on, man.
So what do you got for me, Tony? It's your turn for trivia.
All righty. Well, I thought I would kind of meld two sports together. I'm going to butcher this lady's last name, and I apologize. Jen Powell, yesterday became the first woman to umpire in Major League Baseball, and I believe she was behind the plate today.
Yep.
And then the Braves Marlins. And so what I'm wondering, Marty, who was the first woman to officiate an NBA game?
Oh, gosh. I don't have the faintest clue. You got me. I don't even need three buzzers because I don't even have a name for the first buzzer. So
I thought you might get this one. Yeah. Violet Palmer, all the way back in 2006. So almost 20 years ago. So the NBA was way ahead of Major League Baseball in that area.
Yeah, that makes sense. I, you know, the Major League Baseball is kind of like the Catholic Church. It changes very, very slowly. You know, it's been around for a long time, and it changes very, very slowly. So, sorry, I don't mean that in a anti-Catholic. I'm Catholic, all right? So.
Well, no mail on this.
Yes. No derogatory comments, please. So, Violet Palmer. Now, that face, that African-American gal, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So I think I know who it is. Now that you say the name, I'm pretty sure I know the face. So that's good. You know, I think even if Mel Allen were around when she debuted, he would have said,
"How about that?"
So we take that clip. Little side note here. Sorry about this, folks. We take that clip from the Naked Gun, the original Naked Gun. And on Friday, as part of our staycation anniversary weekend, we went to see the new Naked Gun, Tony.
How was it?
That good, huh?
It was okay.
Okay, so Liam Neeson's not going to be a threat to do any more comedy movies?
He is not... Oh, what's the guy's name? Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah,
he is safe in the pantheon of Frank. I mean, it wasn't the worst movie I've ever seen in a theater. That would probably go to, you remember this movie about 5 years ago, 5-6 years ago, Holmes and Watson with Will Ferrell, and yeah, I literally almost I think we walked out of the theater. It was so awful. Oh. I mean, it was bad. We laughed at parts, but tough shoes to fill. Let's leave it at that. So, that's my Siskel and Ebert moment of the week.
Okay.
So, but to also celebrate and to tie this into here, you know, Mrs. Blum for her anniversary, you know what she got, Tony? Actually, she didn't. We classed it up and went to Runza here, in Nebraska, staple for lunch. But no, we've got some Arby's to give out. Let's start with Luka Doncic and his contract extension, $55 million a year, 3 for $165. Could have made more on this contract, but he took the shorter contract with the less money, so that it looks like in a couple of years, and I forget the exact years, I think 3 years from now, I think there's a player option on the third year with this one, but that will put him at year 10. And at that point, he in theory could sign for 5 years for $405 million, or what we say in Nebraska, that is Cedar Rapids Public Schools money right here. So, your thoughts, my friend.
You know, it makes sense. He's a loyal guy. You take a look. I think I've heard he's lost like 30 pounds. You know, he will be on a short list of, I think, for MVP contenders next year. The Lakers have, you know, passed the torch, so to speak, from LeBron to Luka. And, you know, he'll have a chance, like you said, to get more money here after this contract runs out. Or if he doesn't like the way that the franchise is headed, he could also head out of town there as well. But, you know, they're starting to construct the roster around him and not worry as much about LeBron. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think that I'm sure there have been discussions to, you know, we're going to take care of you, help us out here in the short term while we kind of transition. And this is the best way we can give you more help in the short term as well. And we're going to figure out what we're going to do with Austin Reeves, you know, so forth. But I think that Luka's going to be siding on that dotted line. I mean, that's going to be, I teach history and I'm just going back to school tomorrow, Tony. But that's $80 million a year. He is basically going to make $1 million, another Dr. Evil reference here. $1 million he's going to make to take a ball and throw it in the hoop. How can you do that? That is a ridiculous amount of money, but he's the best at it and he deserves it.
Amen.
We just lost half our listeners. But, all right.
So we're down to one.
And I want to thank Rita. I really do. let's give out some more Arby's, or let's have them pick it up for us. De'Aaron Fox, 4 years, $229 million. A lot of people were wondering what the Spurs were going to do. I like this, Tony. I think they've got three guys for two spots, and they're going to let them figure it out over the next couple of years. And there will be a market for De'Aaron Fox down the line. And I think it's, and obviously he's making a lot of money, and the Spurs have a really good player committed to them for the long term. I think this is a win-win for both sides. Your thoughts, my friend?
I would agree. If the Spurs were a stock, I would buy heavy. De'Aaron Fox, I think, is a really good player. He's going to love playing. I don't know how much him and Wemby played together last year. It wasn't very much at all. You take a look at the Castle kid that they have as well. They guys had some more good picks out of the draft again this year. This is a great fit. The Spurs will be a major player in the West for a long time.
Stephon Castle's dad, Stacy Castle, Briarcliff graduate.
Did you really?
Yeah, did you know that?
I did not know.
He played his senior year at Briarcliff. So, nice guy. Great guy. Really, really, really good dude. So, I think this is a good deal for both Fox and the Spurs. And I agree. The Spurs are they're going to be hard charging here in the next couple of years. The Thunder are going to be right there. I think the Rockets are in a good place. You know, the Western Conference just isn't getting any easier anytime soon,
no.
Tony.
And everybody in the East has tore their Achilles tendon. So who knows? I mean, what will come out of the East? But the West is a dog-eat-dog world.
Absolutely. Youth sports today has become a billion-dollar industry nationwide, and grassroots basketball has been at the epicenter of this explosion. As players, parents, and handlers chase the almighty scholarship, NIL deal, and branding creation, there is still one place where basketball coaches and players come as a rite of passage to develop their games without the fanfare and adulation of recruiting gurus, next-level evaluations, and social media highlight reels. It's not a basketball camp, it's a basketball school. Snow Valley Basketball School started as the brainchild of Herb Livesey, who, as a young adult, was inspired by the great Bob Cousy to start his own basketball camp. Starting in 1961 at Snow Valley Ski Resort east of Los Angeles before moving to Westmont College in Santa Barbara, this camp was a rite of passage for the game's greatest coaches throughout the 1970s and 80s. Two Iowans, Don Showalter and Jerry Slykus, adopted Livesey's curriculum and brought the camp to Waverly, Iowa in 1994 at Wartburg College, where it will celebrate its 30th anniversary in 2025. This is the story of America's longest continuously running basketball camp. It's where players come to learn and coaches come to teach. It's the home to the Last of the Cowboys. The Last of the Cowboys, the story of Snow Valley Basketball School, is available on Amazon.com right now for $17.99. Order your copy today. Let's talk a little WNBA here, Tony, to kind of wrap things up for this week. Big trade here. I think I'm saying that right. DeJounte Carrington traded from the last place Dallas Wings to the first place and really kind of starting to run away from everybody else in the standings here. Minnesota Lynx. God, I couldn't think of their nickname for a second there. This is the rich get richer, I think, Tony. I think Carrington is a really, really good fit. And I think the Lynx are kind of taking the route of the 2014 San Antonio Spurs, really upset with the way that they lost the WNBA Finals last year. And instead of moping about it, they've come back and they're better than ever. And Carrington, I think, is going to be a really, really big part of that formula.
Yeah, I mean, you take a look at Carrington and, you know, she left Connecticut, as pretty much everybody did except for Marina Mabry. But anyway, she went to the Wings. Thought she'd have a bigger role. It didn't work out for her. I'm not trying to be mean. She just wasn't her game didn't fit that role, didn't fit that system, whatever. And now she goes to Minnesota and basically she gets to do what she does. She gets to play great on-ball defense, move without the ball, and the Leafs have enough really good players around her that if she's open, they'll find her. But she gives them a lot of flexibility, gives them a piece that they were missing, a really, you know, football-type defender on the ball. And the Leafs, in my mind, are heavy favorites to win the WNBA title. But at the same time, it'll be interesting to see once you go through and take a look at New York, once they become healthy again and get all their pieces back together. I think Stewie said end of this month she should be back. Will they have enough time to get that chemistry with everybody healthy? And I don't know. But at the same time, the Lynx were playing the other night. They were up a ton and had Collier in, and she rolled an ankle. She's going to be out a couple weeks there too. Mm-hmm. But that might actually be a blessing in disguise, but they're going to have to take and get Collier and Carrington on the same page there towards the end of the month as well.
You know, it's not, and they've got enough of a buffer that I don't think anybody, the math is going to be very, the math is math, and it's saying that it's going to be hard to catch the Lynx for regular season best record. And with Collier being out, she is, you know, she gets a little bit of a break for a couple of weeks. We know what she's capable of. It allows Carrington to get acclimated to the situation. I think my math is correct here, Tony. I think Minnesota, after they beat the Liberty again here today, they've won 10 of their last 11. And two of those are against Liberty. Now, again, like you said, Breanna Stewart out with the bruised knee, but Nafisha Collier out with her sprained ankle. So it's the two of the three or four best players in the league both out, and yet the Lynx still take it. The Liberty, I believe this is the first, or they are undefeated when they've had all five starters playing, and Carter Plum would be the expert on that. He would know that for sure. So that is a little bit of a thing to think about before we just crown the Lynx. But at the same time, boy, they are looking really, really good. And again, my favorite player in the W, Nafisha Collier, she is just, I just love the way she plays the game. And she's the center of the universe. She's the heliocentric type of player, obviously their best player, but they're the parts that they have around here play so well off of her, and they fit her strengths, and it's just a really, really fun basketball team to watch.
And she is the very definition of a two-way player. She's one of those that defensively does not take any possessions off, guards the other team's best player, and you kind of wonder, will she be able to do that throughout the entire playoffs? And I think that's where Carrington comes in and relieves some of that pressure for her.
Mm-hmm. Episode 139 in the books, Tony, Developing Floor Generals. We're going to rename this. Last piece of advice, information that you have for coaches listening to this on developing floor generals.
Well, as far as the floor general goes, make sure you empower them. Don't cut them off at the knees. They're going to have the ability and permission, if you will, to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And there are going to be times that you butt heads. But at the same time, if you will, I guess, commit to it, the amount of growth and the success that can come down the line is so great. And so just stick with it and keep giving them steps and stages and phases as you go. Mm-hmm. That would be my advice on that one.
Yeah, you've got to play the long game, and you've got to think about the big picture. You can't micromanage. You've got to allow your teams to work through this. And that starts with your floor leader. And you've got to show that by example. And there's little stories, like one of the great stories that college basketball. I don't know why I remember this story, Tony, but I remember it. When Bobby Hurley was a freshman at Duke, the very first practice, Coach K, he said, all right, Leitner, you go here, this guy go here, this guy go here, whatever. And he gave the ball to Hurley. And he said, all right, Bobby, run, whatever. And it kind of made some of his teammates mad, because, like, wait a minute, he just gets to walk in here, and from day one, he's a starter. Leitner didn't even get that treatment, and Brian Davis and some of these other guys. But, Kay was thinking about the long game, and he knew that he knew what he had, and he knew that he was going to have to let this kid fail and succeed at various different levels, and he was going to have to live with those failures at times in order for those successes to happen. So I think that's a great example of just, hey, this is who we're going to go with. This is who I believe in. Now, if you make that kind of statement, whether it's an actual statement or it's a statement by your actions, you've got to stick with it, and you've got to put your trust in that kid until you literally get to the point where you just say, nope, we can't do this anymore. But if you're a smart coach and if you know your team, you're probably going to feel you wouldn't make that type of statement without really thinking it through and knowing that this is the right thing to do for our group.
Yeah, and Bobby went on to have a pretty decent career for the Blue Devils.
Yeah, he did. He did okay. He did okay. So, episode 139 in the books. Tony DeVis back in the saddle. Great to have him back. We covered a lot of stuff here this week. We've got a lot of good things planned. We've got a new opening tip newsletter coming out later on this week. Hoops 365. Tony, I can officially say Hoops 365 coming out Tuesday, September 16th. That is going to be the official date where that is going to be available to the public. And it's going to be, we're very close to ending the editing process and getting everything ready to go. And again, I'm biased. I get it. I understand. Coaches, this is going to be a great tool for you to use if you want to be a better coach. And it doesn't matter if you're a rookie coach, if you're an assistant coach, if you're a seasoned and experienced head coach, there's going to be a ton of stuff in this book that's going to help make you a better coach. So Tuesday, September 16th, Tony, that's the official day that Hoops 365 is going to be coming to the world here. So really, really
looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. So, that's about all we've got here. That's it. That's as Ferris Bueller said, it's time for you to go home. Go home.
We're done.
The movie's over. So, coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.